I'm here with Peter Zion. Peter, thanks for joining me again.
Hey, it's great to be back.
Well, so first, you've been on the podcast several times, and most people will have heard about you, seen you somewhere, if not here. But remind people briefly what you do, what's your day job when you're not doing podcasts like this?
My job is to take demography and geopolitics and use it to paint a picture of the future and then show how it matters to the people who happen to be in front of me. So most of my clients are in the world of finance or manufacturing or agriculture, some sort of economic association or business, and I help them navigate the crazy that is to come.
Hmm. Speaking of predicting the future and actually on points that matter, at least to me and a few of us, last time you were on the podcast, you told me that there was no way that Trump was going to win the 2024 election. So I have to ask you what the fuck happened right at the top.
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Sorry, I slept that day. My general feeling was that it was going to be America's independence that decided how things were going to go. Not people who said they were independent, but really were Republicans and everything but name, but the actual 10% of the electorate that splits their vote, because they had decided the last seven elections. So it felt pretty safe to me. And in the post-election polls, it looks like that group decisively voted against Trump. Everyone else shifted, however. With one exception, Washington State, every state and every demographic shifted substantially towards Donald Trump and allowed him to win with the margin that he got.
Mm. Well, how would you rate his second term so far? We're going to talk about tariffs and foreign policy and supply chain and specifics like China, but what most concerns you? What have there been any pleasant surprises? How would you rate the last 10, 11 months?
I usually try not to be critical of presidents in their first terms because, you know, they're learning. It takes time for the policies to kick in. The world doesn't move on a dime. Second term is different because they should have learned from what happened in their first term. And by that measure, it has not gone well. Most of the stated aims of the Trump administration, things like reshoring manufacturing, increasing its defense position, have actually taken the country in a significantly different direction. And I have not seen an unraveling of national power on this scale since the Soviet breakdown. So far, very impressed with how much damage is being done.
Mm.
This is some combination of Zimbabwe, Argentine economic policy, maybe with just a dash of French statism thrown in.
All right, so let's talk about the unraveling. What are you seeing? Because so over right of center in Trumpistan, I can imagine many people believe that the tariffs are working. We're onshoring American manufacturing. We're building up our manufacturing base. Jobs are going to be returning as a result of all this. We have China right where we want her. And it's really just a picture of American strength. I mean, you know, Trump is the kind of guy you just can't screw around with. Finally, we have a president like that. How are you not seeing this?
Let's start with the tariffs. Yeah. When you do a flat tariff and you tax things at the border, no matter what they are, you need to break down manufacturing into two broad categories. First, you have your simple products, things like plastics or furniture, textiles, where there's only a half dozen manufacturing supply chain steps. And in a high tariff environment, it's relatively easy to relocate some of those steps within the tariff wall. So we are seeing significant build out in the United States for things like furniture and glue and paints and all of that kind of stuff. More complex manufacturers, the hundreds or thousands of steps are very different. So here's automotive, aerospace, electronics, computing. When there are thousands of steps and you only produce, say, half of the steps in country, you have to pay the tariff every time an intermediate product crosses the border. And the end product ends up costing significantly more. So simple math, it's easier to take the steps that are within your tariff zone, move them outside of your tariff zone, and then you only have to pay the tariff once. So what we're seeing right now is a steady deindustrialization of the value-added, high-skilled, labor-intensive jobs. And instead, replacing them with much lower value-added jobs and things like plastics, or maybe things that are automated because our labor force is too much. So we've seen contraction in the manufacturing sector for the last 6 months. And the number that I pay attention to the most right now is it called industrial construction spending. It's a data point put out by the Federal Reserve. And it's been negative since tariff day. Hmm. So people are finishing the industrial projects they had started before April, but no one's really launching much that's new.
Hmm. So what are you expecting to see in the economy over the next 12 months as a result? I mean, is this synonymous with inflation, what you just described? Or?
Well, if you go back to before April, we knew. We were preparing for the fall of the Chinese system. We were preparing for the end of globalization. We knew we needed to expand our industrial plant. Probably needed to double it and probably needed to increase the power plant by 50% to go with that. There's no way you do that on anything less than a 40-year time frame without a lot of inflation. And I would argue we needed to do it in the next 5 to 6 years. So inflation was already part of my forecast. But now we have deindustrialization going on top of that. And so if we can't turn this around and get back to building things again, and that requires a very different federal policy, we're going to enter a period where we're going to lose the products from abroad at the same time we no longer are producing very many of them here. So we have to still go through that industrial build-out, but now against a backdrop of goods shortages. So the debate now is, do you want high inflation plus productivity or high inflation plus a goods shortage? Neither of these are pretty.
Hmm. So obviously there's been a huge build-out with respect to data centers for AI.
And progressing.
That's the one thing that is has been a bright spot for the market. It remains to be seen whether it's a catastrophic bubble in the end, but
it's definitely a bubble, let's be clear. Whether it's catastrophic, who knows?
It can be a bubble. I mean, we should be clear, it can be a bubble without AI itself being a bubble, right? I mean, there could be this overinvestment and a build out even if AI is in fact the future, right?
Well, there's a lot of unknowns in that statement, so I don't want to overly come down on one side or the other. 15 years ago, 10 years ago, people were aware of large language models, but I don't think there was anyone in the AI space who really thought that LLMs were the thing that was going to break open, and here it is. So expecting the model we're on right now to be what we use in 5 years or 10 years or 15 years is a bit of a stretch from my point of view. Technology doesn't go in a straight line like that. Also, LLMs require a massive amount of processing compute capacity with graphics processing units. And GPUs are the most advanced chips that humans make, and GPUs cannot be made without a fully globalized system. So I actually look at today's build out and like, this is great because every data center needs power to go with it. We need the power regardless. And if we're entering a world where globalization breaks down, we won't be able to make the GPUs. So anything that's installed now is all we have. So while I'm not a believer in the trajectory that we're on, I have no problem with any of the steps we're taking right now.
Do you think we're in the process, however gradual, of onshoring our dependence on Taiwan, or is that not in the cards?
No. There's 100,000 manufacturing steps for high-end semiconductors. The fab facility is an important one. It's an unavoidable one. But there's another 40,000 that are like that. And once you actually have your fab facility, the next step down is testing and packaging, incorporating into components. We do very little here. I'd argue that's much more important. And on the front end is the design and the logistics. We do that. That's the highest value-added part of the process. So this obsession with fabs is actually taking one of the lower value-added steps that's most capital-intensive and putting it at the center of the conversation. And that's just bad reasoning from my point of view. We should be focusing on things that are downstream, closer to the end consumer, if you're worried about national security.
Well, so I want to talk about national security and foreign policy and talk about China and Central America, South America. But just to close the loop on this, what do you think, if this process of what you're calling deindustrialization continues apace for the rest of Trump's term, what are you expecting to change over the course of 4 years?
I mean, there's so little with this administration that goes in a straight line. So that's a really loaded question. Key thing to remember is that Donald Trump still hasn't fleshed out the government. He fired the top several thousand positions, filled very, very few of them, and then surrounded himself with a cabinet that has very little technical experience in anything. So if you think back to Obama, we had a cabinet that was all academics that had never done anything in the real world. Now we have ideologues who have never done anything in the real world. So to expect to get good advice going to the president, even if he was open to hearing it, is pretty thin. And we've now had major policy changes on drug policy, on illegal narcotics, on the Red Sea, on Israel, on Ukraine, on vaccines, on tariffs, because, and I quote, "it's what I feel." We get no straight lines on that. And so you can imagine what's going on in the business community right now. This is the reason why industrial construction spending is falling. No one knows what policy set is going to be tomorrow or next month or next year. And without some degree of continuity or some degree of guide, everything is up in the air and everything is on hold. So if this sort of ambient chaos holds, and we just hit our 600th tariff change since January 20, no one's going to put money to put anything in the ground because they don't know if it's going to be worth their time.
So what's going on with Venezuela and Mexico? I know you focused on cartel violence. Yeah. I mean, Trump has obviously been threatening to deal harshly with the cartels. I think it remains to be seen what he's intending with respect to Venezuela. But how do you view our ramping up hostilities on both those fronts?
Well, let's start with the understood reality on the ground. Venezuela is a very weak state where the state security services have been so focused on crushing political dissent for so long that they've lost control of large tracts of territory. And so some of the cocaine smugglers in Colombia have now used Venezuela as a way to get their stuff to the wider world. It's a minority. It's less than 10% of the flow. Most of it still goes north into Central America and ultimately Mexico, especially Mexico before coming north to the border. But there is a flow that goes through Venezuela. I'd argue most of that flow eventually goes into Europe as opposed to coming to the United States, but it is real. And there is a degree of collaboration among members of the Maduro government in facilitating those flows. I don't know if calling the cartel is the right term. That implies a degree of overarching control that probably doesn't exist, but it is a problem. So anything you want to do against Venezuela on a state security point of view, there's an argument to be made there. However, the Trump administration has yet to brief Congress about any of the details. So none of the intel that supposedly identified the ships has ever been shared with Congress. And what I'm hearing from the military is that there really wasn't any ever. And that's before you consider the legal implications of some of the specific decisions. We had both Trump and Hagseth brag about performing war crimes the week of Thanksgiving, because if you take out an enemy combatant and they've been completely disarmed of any sort of offensive capability, and then you shoot them, that's a war crime. Every treaty the United States has ever signed on international law codifies that. And so now they're backtracking. It's like, well, maybe that's not what we meant. In addition, we now have the USS Ford down there, which is our top supercarrier, badass piece of military equipment. And it was only on the Monday after Thanksgiving that Trump convened a national security meeting with the Joint Chiefs, Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, to begin the discussions about what the goals in Venezuela are. So to this point, the policy has been, let's shake some sabers and see if Maduro will just leave. Now they're starting to have the early discussions about what the policy might be. Very much horse on the wrong side of the cart.
Yeah, it's remarkable that these kind of extrajudicial killings of people on boats in the Caribbean is, it's being kind of roundly condemned, but on its face, it seems like it's has to be in violation of some law or past practice, because, I mean, we don't even kill drug smugglers when we catch them and convict them of drug smuggling. I mean, that's not a capital offense. And yet now we're simply annihilating people who are alleged to be smuggling drugs, and we have been shown no evidence that that's even true. And as you just pointed out, there's this recent case of this really patent war crime where we've bombed the boat, now people are scrambling in the water, and we bomb them again just to make sure everyone is good and dead. I mean, that is unambiguously a war crime. But I mean, the whole idea that we can be just killing people who are suspected of smuggling drugs, well, has that been a past practice? Is that in line with any of our laws?
It's certainly not officially. I'm never going to say that it wasn't done, because there's a lot that happens with covert action in Latin America that, you know, maybe is distasteful, but is not technically illegal by U.S. laws. And the limiting factor here is the War Powers Act. So that was something that was put in place by Congress, bipartisan, in the aftermath of Vietnam, passed by a 2/3 vote. President vetoed it. It overcame the veto. It was like the biggest overcome of the veto that we've ever had in modern history. Every administration since then, including the Trump administration, has said that the War Powers Act is unconstitutional. It's an unconstitutional check on presidential authority, but it has never come up to the courts. And Congress since then has never called the president to account. So either the president has presented his case after 30, 60, 90 days, to justify, and then Congress votes to authorize the military action. That's, for example, how Iraqi freedom happened. Or the president is done within 30 days and folds the situation down. This is the first time that the War Powers Act has been directly challenged over that 30-day threshold, but Congress has done nothing. And unless and until Congress actually decides to act, technically it's legal.
Yeah,
doesn't mean it's right, doesn't mean it'll work.
Congress has been sitting on its hands on virtually every question. What about Mexico? What's happening with our posture vis-a-vis the cartels, and what are the implications of that?
This is actually more of a Biden administration question than a Trump administration question. Under the Biden administration, a significant amount of progress was made at cracking down on the Sinaloa cartel, which for most of the last 15 years has been the most powerful organized crime group, not just in Mexico or in the United States, but in the world. And there was a general agreement that it was the most effective of the drug smuggling organizations because El Chapo ran it as a business. But El Chapo was eventually arrested and has now been put away. And combine that with the effects of the last 5 years' prosecution of his old organization, his sons basically running the place like Uday and Kuse, if you remember those Iraqi assets. Yeah. And has it been 2 years? Is it only a year? Relatively recently. One of Los Chapitos, that's one of El Chapo's sons, convinced the guy who was the chief accountant of the organization to get in a plane and fly to El Paso to look at some real estate.
Yeah.
And the DEA was waiting. So we basically had a shattering of the organization at the top, and there is no longer one Sinaloa cartel. There's like a dozen, and they're fighting one another. That sounds great, but the second largest drug trafficking organization in Mexico in the world is called the Jalisco New Generation Cartel, and they are an order of magnitude more violent. And now they are the most powerful entity, and they are taking over a lot of former Sinaloa territory. So by taking out the big bad, we've helped inadvertently to create a new big bad that by many measures is a lot worse. Because Sinaloa, their kind of guiding idea was you don't shit where you sleep. You bribe local law enforcement so they're on your side. Jalisco, their idea is that the shit is the point. And so the first thing they do when they go into a new territory is shoot the mayor, shoot the police chief, randomly shoot a bunch of people in town so everyone knows who's in charge. And so nobody stands against them. Different model, a lot more violent, not as effective in the long run, but it generates a lot more activity that we are now seeing, among other things, in the murder rate in Mexico.
So has the Trump administration done anything new on that front? I know he's said that he, you know, wants to send in SEAL Team 6 to deal with the cartels. Have we done anything that's actually changed our posture with respect to them?
Not hugely from my point of view, and I don't see that as a reason to love or hate the Trump administration. The core problem is demand-driven. As long as Americans like their cocaine, you know, this is going to happen. And we've discovered that if you take out the kingpins, in the case of the Sinaloa, you create a more fractious environment where there's a lot more competition. That's, for example, one of the reasons why fentanyl has risen. Cocaine requires a supply chain that involves a half a dozen different countries. And it takes about 4 man-hours between the fertilizing, the growing, the processing, and the smuggling for every dose of cocaine. Well, fentanyl, you can buy a bunch of ink precursors on the open market, make a batch of 1 million doses in your garage in a week, and it takes 4 man-seconds to get the fentanyl in. So we've, by cracking down on cocaine to a degree, we've inadvertently created a new product set. And taking out cartel leaders will have absolutely no effect on that. And one of the things we've ironically seen with the border is by stopping the flow of illegals, it's made it very, very, very easy for all the drug smugglers to just ship stuff in containers. So again, I don't blame Trump for that switch. This is one of those things that as long as people want their narcotics, there is going to be an economic pipeline of some form for it.
What do you know about the recent pardoning of the former president of Honduras, who was a convicted drug smuggler serving time in U.S. custody. So
everything that the Trump administration accuses the Maduro government of being involved in, facilitating drug flows, facilitating drug running, breaking down rule of law, taking advantage of the United States, former President Hernandez, and especially his wife, did and were convicted of on a margin that's more than an order of magnitude bigger than anything that's ever been accused of Maduro. So the only difference between the two of them is that Hernandez said something nice publicly to Trump. And so he got a pardon. Hmm. It's like, if I worked for law enforcement in the United States right now, I would be livid.
Well, I mean, it seems a strange question to ask because there's endless evidence that Trump's fans do not really care about his incoherence. But this is such a startling juxtaposition. I mean, we're now killing people in the Caribbean, ostensibly because we're taking such a hard line on drug smuggling. And in the same breath, we are pardoning one of the more egregious drug traffickers in recent memory who was convicted in the U.S. and it was in a U.S. prison.
Yeah, no, I agree. Whether or not this is going to translate to any political move among Trump supporters in the United States, I have no idea. They've been remarkably loyal to this point, despite policies that keep coming out that actually hurt them. If I were you, I would watch the American agricultural community. They're the sector that has been most hurt by the tariffs to this point. They're not going to recover during the Trump administration. Agriculture is the last thing that gets defaulted into any trade agreement. Hmm. And so even if Trump was able to deliver on the promise of a full renegotiation of everything, which honestly hasn't started because that part of the government hasn't been staffed up yet, that won't manifest as higher incomes for these people this decade. So we're probably looking at something significantly worse than the 1980s farm crisis, and that means probably losing 25% to 33% of American producers. But so far, at the moment, farmers are still supporting Trump, even though it's devastating their pocketbooks. Hmm.
Okay, so China, how are things looking in China? And from here, with respect to our power contest, with this rising power.
It's muddled. And the problem is that the leadership style of Donald Trump, of making sure there's no good advisors around him so he can never be countermanded, that is something that he didn't invent. That's something that Chairman Xi in China invented. So we now have a president of the United States that has gotten no good advice for the last year and is running the country based on what he feels. Hmm. He's said that multiple times. Xi's been doing that for the better part of a decade at this point. And so we're seeing real fissures within the economic system where things were really breaking down because they don't make economic sense. And we're seeing a degree of spasming in their foreign policy as they just whip it back and forth between approaches because no one can feed what's actually going on up to the top. So you may remember during COVID, we had something called warrior wolf diplomacy, mm-hmm. and it sabotaged China's relationships with most of the world. So the people who were responsible for that were sent to the interior of the country to do pointless things where they couldn't cause any more damage. And now some of these people are back and they're trying it out again. We're seeing the same thing in bank regulation. We're seeing it how they run their financial sector. We're seeing it in their agricultural system. The bureaucrats are doing what they hope the boss wants, but they're not coordinated or collected. And the only time you get these little flashes of coherence is when Chairman Xi has to do something on the international scene that requires a few other people. And then all of a sudden there's a few more points of view and there's a more degree of awareness of what's going on. And we get this headbutting between Xi and Trump and their two teams of incompetence, which from my point of view is delightfully entertaining. But we basically have the two most powerful countries in the world that are functionally rudderless in abroad and at home. And it's not going to lead to any place that's particularly great, even if I'm entertained.
Well, what are the implications of Trump having, largely through his tariff machinations, but not entirely, alienated our allies in the face of this kind of growing adversarial relationship with China? I mean, it's a little hard for me to imagine the U.S. effectively uniting India and Japan and Korea and Europe against China, if it ever comes to that, in whether we're talking about an invasion of Taiwan and a military conflict or just a prolonged economic one.
There's any number of ways that this could go. Remember that we're at an inflection point in history right now where the old structures were already breaking pre-Trump. In fact, you could, and this isn't a political thing. Mm. It's just a breakdown of the old Cold War orders. And we've never had a president who said, okay, yes, that doesn't work anymore. It was designed for a different era. So let's reinvent it or try something new. Until Trump II, no president was willing to do that. Trump, for all the crap I give him, and he deserves most of it, is trying something new. Is it something that I think it will work? No. Is it something that I think plays to America's strengths? Also, no. But, I got to give the guy a little props for creativity, because the old system was going to collapse under its weight. It's just now collapsing faster. But that leaves us with two problems. Number one, you have to figure out what it is you want. And this has been the core of American structural weakness since 1989, is that we haven't had that conversation with ourselves. And until you decide what it is you want, you can't then come up with a path to get there if you don't have a destination. So Trump has some things that he feels, but he doesn't know what he wants it to look like on the other side. And so there is no path from here to there. And so the idea of the allies as a strategic asset makes a lot of sense to me for a lot of reasons, but it's not a goal in and of itself. It's a means to an end. And we haven't defined what we want that end to be. And so what Trump is doing, he's doing away with the tool, which will then limit the options of whoever comes after him. And right now, I would argue that our biggest advantages are an agricultural surplus, which is being whittled away by the tariffs, a young population, which is being whittled away by immigration, the alliance structure that is being whittled away by our foreign policy. And so, you know, those are like three of the big five right there. And I'm a little worried about what's happening in the energy sector too. So what Trump is doing is transforming the United States into a normal country. And in a world where the systems are failing, that's not a good thing to be. A lot of what made the United States exceptional is being lost.
Yeah, this is one of the things that worries me when I think of what it would be like to reset after Trump, try to reset all these relationships and, you know, unring the various bells that Trump has been ringing incessantly. Perhaps the most consequential being that our alliances mean nothing, because really in any four-year cycle, we're capable of electing somebody who can just rescind, you know, all of our agreements, effectively including, you know, our support of NATO. And I'm wondering, so imagine we have a, quote, normal president in 2028, you know, whether Democrat or Republican, and he or she wants to return to some kind of new normal, or achieve some kind of new normal, which does sanely leverage all of our alliances with other, you know, stable democracies against, you know, rampaging autocracies of the sort we see in Russia and elsewhere, potentially. Can you imagine a credible reset? I mean, is there a mea culpa so all-encompassing that a new president could utter that would clean the slate and allow us to seem like the durable partner we seemed like to all of our allies before Trump came on the scene?
To the degree that you're hoping for, probably not, but that's also underselling Trump and overselling the value of alliance. During the Cold War, the reason that we had a bipartisan foreign policy is we had the nuclear question hanging over our heads. And so the United States rewrote how the world worked, said, if you are our ally, you get access to our market, but we, and we will protect your commerce so you can sell whatever you want, wherever you want to sell it. But in exchange, we get to run your security policy. And in the case of a hot war, we command your military, not you. Now, in the post-Cold War environment, that clearly needed to be overhauled. But don't think for a second that running a global military without being able to control everyone else's is going to be easier or cheaper. So the allies, such as they were during the Cold War, were part of a strategic pact. That pact no longer exists. There was a hot minute where it looked like we might be reforming that for the Ukraine war. I think that minute has passed. And we need to now reimagine what that structure looks like. And if you think back through American history, with the exception of 1945 to 1992, our foreign policy was never bipartisan. And if you look at the rest of the world outside of that window, the same holds for everyone else as well. So that system was always going to fail, and a new one would have had to be reinvented or an old one brought back. But the idea of a multinational alliance that persists through decades, that was the aberration, not just in American history, but in world history. And we were always going to have to come to cope with that. And by we, I mean everybody. And that means a smaller list of allies, most likely, in the long run. There are some countries that, for reasons of geography or culture, are in the box. So New Zealand, Australia, the United Kingdom, Iceland, Canada on most days. And if we can swing it right, France and Japan are some solid ads. But you get beyond that cluster, maybe the Scandinavians, and it becomes a lot more transactional. It becomes a lot more temporary, and it becomes a lot more based on what's going on in the world. So I agree with you. I thought that the Cold War alliance structure was amazing for many, many reasons. And I would have loved for us to renegotiate that in a coherent way before now. But every presidential election we've had since 1992 has gone with the guy who didn't think it was important enough. And here we are.
So what's happening in China with respect to demography? So you've been, I think, predicting for a few years at least that China's in its last decade in some basic sense. I'm not hearing that from many other people. I mean, I forget where I found this, but this was a measure that I hadn't known existed, and I just want you to react to it. That it was a graph that I saw mapping China's age dependency ratio, and this is the ratio of non-working age people, 15 and under or over 65, to the working age people. And the plot was against America's, and it looked like China's didn't get worse than ours until about the mid-2040s, about 20 years from now. So,
sure. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a very important measure. It's one I follow. A couple things to keep in mind. Number one, there have been a lot of, I wouldn't call them new data releases in China, but more data admittances. The Chinese data is very poor on capturing the existence of people roughly under the age of 25. And so statisticians won't come out with their new guess or their new estimates or their new census, but they'll say, you know, this data that we've done for the last 15 years, that's bunk. We don't believe that anymore. And basically, that's a situation we're in now for basically everyone who's under 30. If you remember back to Tiananmen, what the Chinese government discovered was there were multiple groups of protesters. The ones that the West tended to focus on were the ones who built the Plaster of Paris, Statue of Liberty kind of thing. Those were all the white-collar students. And then you had the farmers and the mechanics who came and protested. And what the Chinese discovered is the people who protested with pocket protectors were a lot easier to run over with tanks than the people who protested with wrenches and trowels. And so there was a decision made at the top. It's like, let's become a white-collar country because it's easier to control and people earn more and we get more taxes. So they started retooling their system at the end of the Deng Xiaoping years. Well, you fast forward to 2019, and they were expecting the first big crop of white-collar students to graduate and in the workforce. But then COVID happened, and the numbers got scrambled. If you remember, China didn't recover from COVID until 2023. So we got our first real data in 2024. And what they discovered is the number of white-collar workers went down. What we found out is Chinese data collection was focused on a few specific things, their equivalent of kindergarten, a specific immunization stage, and those two numbers were based on reporting data from groups that got paid by the number of people that passed through their offices. So they just lied about the number. And for the last 25 years, the birth rate actually has been plummeting. And that's on top of the fact that the U.S. birth rate was already higher than the Chinese birth rate back in 1991. So the Chinese basically haven't repopulated anyone under age 40. And when you look at the dependency ratio, it's people aged 18 to 65 versus those on the edges. Well, the number under 18 is nil. So the dependency ratio looks pretty good, especially when you consider simple mortality in a country like China, where people generally don't live to be 80. But the bottom line is they probably now have more people over age 54 than under. And there isn't an economic model that will work with that by the year 2035.
I can't resist reminding the world that Trump was a fan of how China responded to Tiananmen Square. He thought that was just a good use of tanks, apparently. So what about the prospect that China's problems, such as you just sketched them, can be offset by productivity and automation and just kind of breakthroughs, AI, robotics? I don't know what other kinds of reforms or innovations could fall into that bucket, but is there some loophole here that you haven't acknowledged?
Well, something that we've seen with all the countries that have advanced in age so that they're running out of young people is they become very, very export dependent. And if you're Germany or Korea and it's the 1990s or the 2000s, your option is to sell to the wider world, both the United States and China. Once you hit mass retirement, which is where the Germans are going to be in like 3 years, the model shifts because you no longer have that advanced workforce either. So one of the really interesting things I'm watching in Germany right now is how their political and economic model is going to transform in the next 5 years, because now they're under security pressure and they're losing access to the global market and they're losing their workforce. Something will give. It's just a question of what. As for the things that can help out China, let's just go down the list. Artificial intelligence. In its current form, run by large language models, this is a white-collar replacement issue. Mm. The Chinese economy is manufacturing, it's blue-collar, so it has negligible effect there. Next one down, robotics. That can get a little sexy. Already there are more robots in China than the United States. Granted, they're very, very different kinds of robots, because robots are designed to accentuate what your people do. And so here, we already had the highest value-added workforce in the world. Our robots accentuate that. China's labor quality has actually gone down in the last 20 years. And so there, it's a labor replacement technology. I'm not saying one is good or bad. They're just very different. But it doesn't solve the overarching problem that if China is running out of workers and they replace them with robot workers, they still have product they need to sell and they can't sell it locally because there's no one to buy it. They have to sell it abroad. So if the robot strategy is the one that they're going to go with, they still need an open globalized system to sell product to. They can't do that without the United States. Not only are we the largest market, it's our structures that allow commercial commerce to sail the ocean blue. Without the United States, none of that happens. So I don't see it solving the problem. Third, a little bit longer run, you know, decade plus, robots don't pay taxes. And so if you've got a robotic workforce that has kept up the production side of the equation, you still don't have the other side of the equation at all. Whatever decision they choose matters because it'll adjust things outside of China. Mm-hmm. But none of these save China.
Right. Well, anyone who's followed your work knows that globally speaking, there's a fair amount of doom and gloom, but
that's fair.
There's been this theme of American exceptionalism that it's not to say things won't be interesting for us, but on your account, we are in the luckiest spot imaginable, given the possibilities. I'm wondering if the rosy picture for America on your account has eroded at all. I mean, with respect to just our political landscape, the hyperpolarization of our society, the loss of trust in institutions, the loss of, you just painted a picture of the second Trump administration, which I agree with, which really makes us look like the world's most powerful banana republic with respect to how we're doing our politics. I mean, there's just, it's all loyalty tests and apparently almost no competence. Has your view of America's prospects shifted at all, has it been pretty stable in the last couple of years?
It's definitely slipped. A few big things. The big advantages the United States has: ocean moats, hard to break that. Young demographics, youngest demographic structure in the advanced world, high birth rate, immigration rates round out the difference. Both of those are under attack now. What RFK Jr. is doing with the vaccine schedule is easily going to triple the mortality rate among people under age 18. That's going to be horrific. It's already had a significant downward effect. This is something the Russians are really cheering for. And then, of course, the immigration shutdown has taken out any possible replacement. So in calendar year 2025, the U.S. population dropped for the first time in the history of the Republic, with the notable exception of the Spanish flu back in 1918, I think it was. And unlike in 1918, where it was a one-off event, this is now our trajectory unless something significant changed. And that assumes that RFK Jr. is removed tomorrow. He has a whole new batch of reforms that are coming in that are going to make this significantly worse. And I don't see any reason across the American political landscape, even if Trump were to disappear today, that all of a sudden we'd be more pro-migrant. One of the things that the Democrats get wrong is that the most anti-migration voting faction in the United States are Mexican Americans. Mm-hmm. They might want family reunification for their family, but for nobody else. And the Democrats just haven't been able to wrap their minds around that. We are in a nativist moment. That's not 100% Trump. Next, energy. The United States is now the world's largest exporter of processed materials, about 5 million barrels a day, and the world's second largest exporter of crude oil, more than even the Russians. That requires a degree of government hands-off of the economy, which is one of the reasons why North Dakota and Texas and New Mexico and Colorado have done so well, and Oklahoma have done so well with the shale revolution. The Trump administration is injecting policy into economic decision-making in an almost socialist manner, and it's making the energy companies start to have second thoughts about their investment programs. And so outside of the super majors who can get the White House on the phone, everyone else is pulling back on their investment and their R&D. And that'll have a big long-term effect for the negative. Far more damning for the energy sector than anything Barack Obama ever did. He tried. The military. We now have loyalty tests for the military, and we've spent most of the time since Vietnam about making the military as apolitical as possible, to do what it's told. And we train our officers to be able to make intelligence decisions and be aware of economics and sociology and psychology and history and all the rest when they're leading their men. We're breaking down that system now. We're damaging the academies to a degree that it's already affecting mid-career training for our officers. We won't feel that this year or next year or even in Trump's term, but we'll feel it for 25 years because we've now cut the pipeline. And if you've got a military that is both politicized and less capable, now we do start looking like what you suggested, the world's most powerful banana republic. And that is something that I'm not worried about today, but it's something 10 years from now I'm going to be terrified of. We all should be terrified of what that would look like. Oh, what else? Because we're already pretty depressing. Let's talk manufacturing. So even though the United States only produces about half of its manufactured goods, that other half is for large scale, what we're involved in international trade of. We export crude, we export energy, we export finance. Most of our exposure is in manufacturing. We should be aggressively building that out to prepare for the end of globalization. Instead, the tariff policy has pushed us in the other direction. So we have a limited amount of time. We had a lot to do, and now we have more to do.
What do you see post-Trump? I mean, what are your expectations for 2028 in terms of the political landscape? What's worth hoping for? I mean, what seems plausible without being Pollyannish?
To be perfectly blunt, the race is open. The Democrats as a party have imploded, and they're not coming back in their old format. That coalition of educated coastal elites, the working class and minorities, it's gone. It's not coming back. The Hispanics have completely gone. Organized labor has completely gone. The Democrats just don't have enough of a core to be a meaningful competitor in any race long run. But the Republicans are in just as bad shape because Trump purged the party of anyone who was a free marketer, who was a business conservative, who was a national security conservative, who was a rule of law conservative, certainly was a fiscal conservative. And all that's left is the cult of Trump. So we have one party that is chaos, that can't pull itself together for any reason. And you have another party that's functionally a cult of personality led by a guy who is now older than Biden was when Biden became president. And so when he goes, everything that's below him turns into a bloodfest. So the possibilities for the next election run the gamut from Trump running for a third term to 14 parties contesting the election. We're at a point in American politics where the structure of the parties has broken, but nothing has replaced it yet. It certainly won't be replaced before the midterms. And it's difficult for me to see the Republicans having a transformation so long as Trump is alive, not just in office, but alive. As for the Democrats, there is no leadership any longer. I think they're gone forever as well. So we're waiting for new political forces to form and congeal or consolidate, if you prefer that word, and rise. And we've done this before. This is going to be our seventh political transformation. We'll get through it, but living through it is never fun.
But so you're not imagining many more political parties forming that are viable. I mean, aren't you imagining
viable
some
long term? Of course not. We have a first past the post electoral system. We can only have two long term, but in the short term, we can certainly have more than two.
Do you see a way for the Republican Party to become recognizable again? I mean, assuming there's nobody who can inherit the mantle of the personality at the center of the personality cult of Trump, can you see some kind of reboot where we have kind of normal conservatives, fiscal security, and otherwise?
The last of those people are hanging on in the Senate. This is their last term. They're already gone from the House for all practical purposes, and they no longer have support of the MAGA base. A number of them, whether it is DeSantis or Ramaswamy, have thought that if they kissed up to Trump enough, they could be anointed the successor, but it only takes pissing him off once on one day and you're out of contention forever. So Marco Rubio is attempting to do that right now. He will fail. So will the vice president. And Trump will die without a successor. Or if he does have a successor, it will be appointed on his deathbed. And then the guy won't have any campaign strength going for them, and it won't matter.
Do you see a the prospect of a demagogue like Tucker Carlson grabbing the ring?
People say, I'm dark.
Yeah.
Tucker has been working for the Russians folks for so long. I have a hard time imagining that it could be him, but he's much more intelligent than Donald Trump or Joe Biden were. So I guess I shouldn't reject it out of hand.
When you say working for the Russians, do you mean effectively so or actually so?
Well, it's if you listen to his monologues, it's really easy to pick out the cadence and the terminology that actually comes out of the Kremlin. It doesn't take a lot of linguistic analysis to see that. Now, that doesn't mean that they're like dictating his every step and puppet mastering, but he's clearly more loyal to the Kremlin than he is to the White House.
Yeah, well, his interview with Putin was established that for
that
all
was
time.
Wild.
Yeah, that was amazing. Well, we've covered a lot here. Is there anything that we haven't covered that is at kind of top of mind with respect to what most concerns you or?
I mean, the list has gotten long. If you just want something else
to worry
be aware
about,
of. I'm not sure it's a worry about thing. This is more traditional international economic and security things. What's going on with the revolution in military affairs, largely spearheaded by the Ukrainians to a lesser degree the Russians, is really getting impressive. Russia, not a technical leader. Ukraine doesn't have much of an industrial plant. And yet both are already churning out hardware that can outcompete with anything that China or NATO has.
So you're talking about drones specifically?
Drones are the first phase of it, but that's not it. That's not just it. That's just part of it. So we now have naval chassis that I guess you can technically call a drone called like, it's called the Sea Baby. Horrible name. Ukrainians need help with naming things. But it can range 1,000 miles autonomously and target the part of the vessel that they want to hit. So they hit a couple of shadow tankers off the coast of Turkey, the far side of the sea, the week of Thanksgiving, and targeted the stern to take out propulsion systems. And this is a country that by most definitions is third world. They're already producing jammers that probably on a dollar for dollar basis are more than an order of magnitude better than the best ones the United States has. They are inventing on the fly an entirely new class of military equipment. And kind of like with AI, where this is going to be in 5, 10, 15 years, we have no idea. The last time the world was at this kind of moment, it was the 1860s when the United States was experimenting with industrial military technologies for the first time. And then a little bit later, the Crimean War, where the Brits and the French used some of the lessons of that war to apply the same to the Crimean campaign against the Russians and wiped them out. So whenever you bring a gun to a knife fight, you don't just win, you rewrite what the game is. And we're at the verge of one of those moments right now.
Do you think these developments nullify American advantages militarily in the conventional space? Or are we poised to be the best drone force or, you know, and or any other, you know, novel new weapon system
in the Western hemisphere? No, we're fine. That we have not seen any of these weapon systems display anywhere near the level of range that is required to strike anything in the Western hemisphere. And the thousand mile range of these new weapons that these new weapon systems that the Ukrainians have, whether it's the Sea Babies or the Flamingo cruise missiles, again, 1,000 miles is kind of the outside range. Unless you can quintuple that, there's nothing that meaningfully threatens the homeland. But it does complicate, if not block, traditional military power projection in the Eastern hemisphere. Now, something to keep in mind, the United States, again, is not a trading nation. Everyone in the Eastern hemisphere is. So now, in addition to the demographic issue and the political issue and the strategic issue, we also have a military issue that is going to break the old trading order, because it's really easy to hit a slow-moving tanker or container ship, even if you can't hit the United States. So in the Eastern Hemisphere, everything that I've said about the weaknesses of their system and how it's doomed to a collapse, it just now has one more thing to worry about. The question in my mind is who's going to inherit the second generation of these new technologies. The Ukrainians have said that anyone who puts boots on the ground in Ukraine gets full access to everything we're doing in real time. From my point of view, ignoring the Russians, ignoring the fact that they're pointing nukes at us, ignoring that they've turned sexual assault into a state policy, just for that, it's worth being involved with Ukraine.
Yeah, so what do you think our policy should be with respect to Ukraine? I mean, presumably we should have armed them faster and more lavishly than we have, and never made a secret of that commitment and never rescinded it. Certainly once we saw how vulnerable the Russian military was, I mean, the expectation was they were going to own Kyiv in a matter of days or weeks. But once they got bogged down, shouldn't we have just, I mean, this really falls to Biden as well. Shouldn't we have just ramped up our support and kept it there?
With the benefit of hindsight, it's really easy to say that. Just keep in mind that if you misjudge once, you lose New York City and Chicago.
So you think that the threats of nuclear blackmail were credible enough to explain our dithering?
Well, we now know that they're not, but we didn't know that then. And the only way to find out was to call the bluff. And if you try to call all their bluffs at the same time, that might have triggered them to do something a little punchier.
Well, so why do you say we now know that they're not?
Because we haven't been nuked. And we've done most of those things you identified now. It's like the Russians gave us a specific red line. We tiptoed up to it. We towed across it. And then we stepped across it. And one of the allies always went first, whether it was Poland or Latvia or Sweden or the United Kingdom. And then we all did. And we did that, I think, 90 times over 3 years.
Right.
So it's easy for me to say we could have gone faster now that we know, but we didn't know. So I really don't have too big of a problem with that. What we're doing now, however, is though, remember, Trump has made sure he has surrounded himself with people who aren't experts. And he's tapped Steve Witkoff, who knows nothing about foreign affairs and nothing about history, and has publicly said that he's proud of that and has no intention of rectifying it, as the primary interlocutor between Vladimir Putin and the White House. So basically, he goes into the White House, the Russians sit him down, tilt his head back, pour propaganda down his throat, and then he goes to the White House and vomits it forth. That is the primary connection to the White House. And before you consider things like Tulsi Gabbard, who's subtly sabotaging things the whole way, the only times that we get meaningful progress on the Ukraine issue in this administration are when someone else like General Kellogg has been involved, who, you know, military, knows what a Russian is. Or ironically, when Donald Trump takes the first lady with him on an international trip, because he comes back after talking to Witkoff, like, oh, the Russians have been so hurt and everything. And she's just like, oh, so is that why they bombed a children's hospital? Pulls it up. And she has become the unofficial ambassador from Ukraine to the United States. The fact that all the facts are on her side makes it easier, but she's one of the few people who can actually challenge somebody like Witkoff or Gabbard.
And meanwhile, Witkoff has gone to Russia, I think, 6 times and has not gone to Ukraine. And it's, I don't know if you saw this recent Wall Street Journal article that detailed all the ways in which we seem to be in the process of selling out Ukraine so as to enrich friends of Donald Trump Jr. in various deals that, I mean, we're trying to bend this all toward a kind of kleptocratic spoils situation in the aftermath of whatever peace we force Ukraine to accept.
Well, I thought that the Russians are trying something new here because they're really finding the first lady to be really aggravating because she's just so direct. But after Witkoff's most recent trip, the one in early November that generated the 28-point peace plan, two thoughts. Number one, first the bad. In it was a $100 billion bribe for the United States. The federal government could distribute however it wanted.
Yeah, I wonder how that would go.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, huh. It's like, you know, A for directness. Right. It's like speaking to the man. The other thing, though, Kellogg did have a role in that. And if you look at all of the issues that were in those 28 points, it said that, for example, Russia would have to say that the security environment, post-Cold War security environment in Europe is now settled and they can't bitch about it anymore. They have to codify into Russian law that Ukraine is a state. They have to release all the children that they've kidnapped, and they appointed a cabinet-level representative to facilitate the mass kidnapping of Ukrainian children. And then, of course, all the things we've heard of in the news that were bad for the Ukrainians. The point is, for the first time in this administration, all of the issues that exist in this conflict were actually being discussed at the same time. That has never happened before,
right?
Because there's never been anyone in the administration who was a policy expert. So I actually saw it as kind of a weird step forward in that we are finally to first base. Now, where we go from there, Who knows? And obviously, Witkoff is back in Moscow now, I believe, today. So the Russians are not giving up. But just having discussion of the reality of the situation as part of the conversation is a huge step forward. I mean, anyone else, they would have done that before day one. But for this administration, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, acknowledging that the kids had been stolen and needed to be repatriated was kind of shocking progress. It almost seems like an error that they thought better of. Well, Peter, once again, it's been an education. Thank you so much for your time. Remind people where they can find your work on the regular.
Everything that I do is at the website, zeihan.com. That's Zeihan.com.
Thank you, Peter. Great to talk to you.
Likewise.